Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome and thanks for joining us. I just got off the Skype phone with Mike Osborne to talk about his new book, The Emergence of Tropical Medicine in France. This came out in 2014 with the University of Chicago Press. Now, despite the seeming coherence of France as a place in the title, what the book does is actually introduce us to the centrality of place and places in the history of medicine by taking this notion of France or French colonial medicine and really exploding it to show us at very different levels of approach, at very different ways of zooming in, the kinds of places that are made by naval and colonial medicine in this period and the ways that naval and colonial medicine are shaped by places. And those are places including, you know, France and the colonies, their towns, individual cities, and places like prisons and ships. And so you'll hear all about that in the conversation to come. This is a book that is of interest if you imagine yourself as somebody who really likes to read about history of medicine or history of France or the history of and with place. And or if you just like a really good story, and you'll hear some of those stories and some of the character sketches that come up in the book just in just a few moments. So I hope you have a chance to read the book. It's really fascinating, and I think it makes a number of really significant contributions to the historiography of medicine and of colonial medicine in particular. And I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks for listening. I'm here today to talk with Michael Osborne about his new book, The Emergence of Tropical Medicine in France. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Mike, and thanks for making time to talk with me today. I love the book, and I am super excited to talk with you about it. So thank you for being here, and welcome. So, Mike, could you start us off by saying just kind of a little bit about what brought you to the field of the history of science, and specifically, how did you come to decide to work on France in particular within the history of science?
Well, one of the decisions that we all make if you, when we, I guess, want to be a professor or at least get a PhD is a topic of study. And there was a time in my life when I thought, well, I'll do American history. But in fact, I thought, why should I spend time in New Jersey looking at archives when maybe I could go to someplace exotic? And for me, that was France. The other thing that happened was as an undergraduate, I became extremely interested in science and politics. I read biology and political science as an undergraduate and always retained that interest in the politics of science. And finally, before I went to graduate school, I just picked up after working for about 6 months and moved to France and just threw myself into language acquisition. Later went back to the Sorbonne and other places. So France was a specific choice of mine in terms of something to study. I could cite, for example, Peasants and the Frenchmen, which is a fabulous book on logics of localism a number of years ago, and I was just enthralled with that. So I was pointed toward France as an undergraduate, but without any French language skills. I subsequently moved to France and gained those skills. So when I went to graduate school, I continued in that vein. The person I studied with was also a European historian, and he had written a couple of books on France. So that's how I got to where I am.
Great. So the book that we're here to talk about today is a history of French colonial medicine, which was largely in this story, or a big part of that in this story, was naval medicine in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Can you situate this within your larger research trajectory? How did you come to focus on this particular topic and also to write a book-length object about this particular topic?
Well, I was quite enamored of French culture and thought that I knew it after visiting Paris and also going to school there. It's been a few years, so I was able to attend lectures by Michel Foucault on my first trip to France. And subsequently, after hearing lectures there in Paris, I moved to Grenoble and some other places in the provinces and just thought, my goodness, this is very different. People will cut you a break here in the south of France, when I was in Toulon and other places, if you don't speak perfect English. And I began to hear that, you know, for a lot of people, French is really, even today or then in the 1980s, not their first language. Okay, they spoke Provençal or Breton at home, or they knew both. So this topic of French naval medicine intrigued me while I was working on my first book, and I just kind of put it away. The object of the first book was to show that the acquisition of empire, in fact, had an effect on science at the core of empire, which at that time I was thinking, well, it's Paris, right? That's the capital. But we'll say French science. The arguments of that time, that early historiography had basically, some people had argued that, no, acquisition of empire didn't do anything for science. But it seemed to me that there were a couple easy ways to trace that out. One was to look at zoos, which I did in the first book. And of course, there's a lot of exotic animals in Paris and all over France coming in from around the world. Secondly, in terms of what we call exotic peoples and diseases, and that is where I shifted then to look at what was happening in the provinces and particularly the port cities. And so it turned out that in terms of learned institutions, particularly in Toulon, which is the major French port on the Mediterranean, naval port, but also in Bordeaux and some of the other cities, Brest, on the Atlantic seaboard that I looked at, the Navy was vastly more important than many other sorts of cultural and industrial concerns and institutions. So with that in mind, I said, well, I should look at the Navy. Initially, I had thought that I should look at the Army, and I played with that for a while. But there's been a lot of things written about the French Army and also French Army physicians. And in some ways, that's correct, because the Army was a very important cultural institution for France, particularly after Napoleon, because it's the Army where most of the military battles take place. So it's interesting to see now that today, if we could just reflect on this topic, that the Army has in fact incorporated naval medicine. And what I tried to do in this book was to show that, look, there were separate trajectories, multiple trajectories, important things happening in the provinces. So in many ways, it is a tour of the coastal areas of France, particularly the five naval ports, of Rochefort, Brest, Toulon, Lorient, and Cherbourg. One of the reasons that I did this book was that I think the historiography of the history of French medicine is still extremely Paris-centered, and there are good reasons for that. But I was trying to destabilize that narrative and also just have a wonderful time visiting these places in the provinces.
Thank you so much. So you've already said a little bit about some of, at least what I took to be some of the most important broader historiographical contributions that the book is making. So in addition to focusing on naval medicine, which brings us to a different set of places, right, or spaces than we ordinarily might focus on in histories of colonial medicine, and we'll talk a little bit about those places in a moment. Focusing on naval medicine also really changes how we understand what the history of colonial medicine looks like in this period. So in addition to, again, the focus on naval medicine, can you talk a little bit about, as we now move into the book, what are some of the other ways that the work you're doing here is revising the kind of larger picture that we have of the history of colonial medicine in this period?
Well, for example, most French physicians who serve overseas in the 20th century are trained in Marseille, or at least they have what we'd call postgraduate training, either in Marseille most often in Marseille, but also in Toulon. So on the Mediterranean seaboard, one of the things that tropical medicine, I think, which generally tropical medicine is a marker that comes about, you could say, in that decade before World War I, and it's based on parasitology, medical parasitology. We have the discovery, of course, of the parasitic nature of diseases like malaria. And I think one of the things that I tried to do in the book, and I hope it's successful, is to tell a counter-narrative. That is, the standard narrative is that we've got the Pasteur Institute, and we've got Pasteur, and we've got these diseases that he's able to work out. I mean, anthrax, for example, but several other sorts of diseases that he works with, and the production of vaccines. But to take a look at the people that actually served overseas, sometimes for many years, or in one instance in my book, a person who took 19 voyages and colonial postings over a career, to look at the training of those people, and turns out that they were not quite as modern as one would think. When you think of Pasteur and his science, it is very new. But these people, around 1900 or so, these people are trying to engage with that new way of looking at diseases and peoples, and yet stay firm or steadfast to certain traditions, of which things like medical geography, for example, were extremely important for naval and beyond that, military physicians. In other words, localization of diseases. It's not unlike what we're seeing now with this unfortunate Ebola outbreak. That is to say that we need to look at contacts of people. We need to look at the local context. Suppression of diseases in a place like Saint-Louis in Senegal, where one of the major yellow fever outbreaks that we've seen on the face of the globe happened in the 1860s, is not as easy in terms of suppressing a disease or as you might find, say, in France proper, particularly in Paris. So the medical police element is less disciplined. This stands in contrast, I think, to what you find on ships, where in many ways the medical policing, the hygiene, and the sanitation is very disciplined. And I think there's a difference in status of patients. There's a lot of elements there. But naval medicine had another sort of worry, or I should say another vector that distinguishes it, I think, from civilian medicine. And one of the things that the naval physicians are very worried about is being incorporated into the Army. And in fact, that has now happened. You won't find any of these institutions that I wrote about training naval physicians that are still on the coast. That happened just recently. So incorporation into the Army is one of the things that I wrote about. Linked with that is a series of pleas, actually, or statements or arguments about why naval medicine is special, and therefore we need these special schools. So the ranking system in the Army and the Navy is a bit different. Secondarily, though, in terms of civilian medicine, which is in many ways what we know the most about, and particularly people that were trained at the Paris Faculty of Medicine, in terms of the panorama of history of medicine in France in the 19th and 20th century, one of the things that distinguishes, I think, Navy medicine from civilian medicine is that the people that are practicing civilian medicine, certainly in the 20th century, they have MD degrees. And many of the people that I wrote about, although it's changing by the mid-20th century, or it has changed, I should say, by the early 20th century, never attained the MD degree. They're surgeons. They are what we would call, say, health officers. They have like 2 years of training. And the training often is very much on a apprenticeship model, not necessarily in a clinic, but on ships. So there's a distinctiveness, I think, of naval medicine that I tried to bring out at various places in the book.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think along these lines, this brings us to another really crucial element of the book's argument, and that is the importance of place. So in several different ways, the book really revises not just our notion of the importance of place in colonial medicine, but really the kinds of places that matter. So rather than focusing on colonial medicine in the context that a lot of other studies do, which is the British Empire and mostly India, and sort of projecting this kind of pan-European model, on one level, the book refocuses our attention on place by focusing on France, not Britain, and not proposing a pan-European model. On another level, it focuses, again, as you already suggested, not on Paris, but on different localities in France to sort of take us into the plurality and the texture of places within France. And then on yet another level, perhaps a third level where places manifest, you also bring us into kinds of places like prisons and ships and ports, which are also really crucial to shaping colonial medicine in this context, and naval medicine in particular, and sort of helping us, I think, integrate this case within a larger understanding of colonial medicine writ large and its historiography in this period. So the first chapter really sets the stage by introducing three of the port cities, three of the naval ports that are going to become really important to the book. One is Brest, one is Rochefort-sur-Mer, and one is Toulon. And I apologize in advance for my pronunciation of everything. So you take us in this first chapter into these places and talk about the differences among them and then the kind of particularities of what it would have been like to live in these places. And you talk here about the differences between naval and civilian healing, much along the lines that you just spoke with us about in your description of the particularities of naval medicine. Now, one of the really interesting things that comes out of this chapter is a movement into looking at prisons as spaces of naval medicine and colonial medicine, and looking at the ways that, in particular, prisons become these sites for working out ideas of race and forensics and criminal psychology. So to take us into this first part of the book, would you talk a little bit about the importance of prisons as places for your story?
I'd be delighted to. So just to recap, as you mentioned, the three major cities where there were prisons, and those are naval prisons, which are a certain kind of prison, a Bang prison, for example, are Rochefort-sur-Mer, Brest, and Toulon. Toulon's Bang system lasted longer than the other two, and it was also the biggest one. So, for example, in the 1870s, after the Paris Commune, which was were a group of socialists and others that were suppressed. Many were murdered, but also some in 1870, 71 or so, right when the Second Empire falls and France changes governments to the Third Republic. The Bang prison at Toulon, in fact, received some of these prisoners from this insurrection, who are then shipped to the French colonies. One of the things with the Bangs is that increasingly, by the time we get to the 19th century, they are seen, and we're talking here about several thousand men. I give some figures in the book, but several thousand men, sometimes women, who are basically in a work camp. Now, that means that they might be working at the naval arsenals that are in all three of those cities, very hard backbreaking labor, or they might be farmed out and in the community. But basically, for the men, they sleep on racks at the prison at night, and they're chained together. They're chained. And some of the ideas that I talked about there in terms of the specificity of this kind of prison life was that it's very different from the sort of stuff that Michel Foucault wrote about in terms of prisons. It's not as a disciplined a place as I think Michel Foucault's visions of prisons were. There's not much in terms of redemptive value, which Foucault had claimed that civilian prisons had at this time, and not much that I can see at least happening at these various banks. In terms of naval medicine, this is where most of those colonial physicians cut their teeth in terms of looking at ideas of race and also at in terms of epidemiology. So as a medical student in the French Navy, at one of these three ports, you would be expected, to work at one of these prisons for, say, evening shift or something. And you would also have a specific class in prison medicine. And so that's, again, another additional point of specificity for naval medicine. Now, the other thing about the Navy, but also these prisons, that is intriguing for historians is they have very good records, particularly medical records that were kept. So one of the things I talk about in Chapter 1 was an alleged homosexual affair that happens in Toulon, and unfortunately, one of the people is murdered, and there's an investigation of that by a surgeon who is there. Another thing in terms of race, though, is that it's noted within these prisons that certain prisoners with certain kind ethnicities, and the categories here are extremely broad, such as Arabs or Africans or Jews, or sometimes you get down to the French regional level of Brestois, someone from Brest, or Rochefortais, something like that. But what they start noticing is that, for example, the Arab prisoners, as they call them, are able to sustain certain things, diseases like cholera, but not so much, for example, typhus. And so they start noting that certain ethnicities seem to be susceptible to certain diseases. This sort of accounting, which I talk about in the book, is extremely important, particularly when this technique or this reconnaissance happens on various ships for the Navy. So, for example, when the Navy is dealing with really an epidemic of lead poisoning in the middle of the 19th century, it's noticed that the Africans, who just happen to be of the Islamic faith, are not drinking water from the cisterns, and they're not suffering from what's called dry colic. We would call it lead poisoning now. And so race was extremely fundamental to looking at a number of diseases, and there's many physicians then who incorporate that in their MD thesis in the Navy, those at least that go on to get an MD.
Great. Race actually continues to be important throughout the story. And as we get into Chapter 2 and 3, Chapter 2 specifically takes us into a really detailed study of this case of lead poisoning, which is related to a disease called dry colic, in using this case study to look more broadly. And I mention this for listeners who are particularly interested in ideas of the laboratory, more broadly at the idea of the ship as a space. And the ship is a laboratory space that's used to work out ideas of place, ideas of, in the case of this lead poisoning / dry colic, industrial health and technological modernity. So there's a really interesting chapter on the ship as a place in these contexts, and that's Chapter 2. And as we get to Chapter 3, we get into a really fascinating opening up of these ideas of race and ways of understanding and really the pluralities that are involved in understanding ideas of race along the lines that you just mentioned. So I think maybe it's a good time to turn there. Chapter 3 raises a number of different ways that the people that you're studying thought about and conceptualized race. And in many ways, these are quite different from what readers or listeners may have assumed coming into the book. So I think it's worth talking a little bit about. Now, one of these ways of thinking about race that comes up that's quite different from what I had read about previously and was really wonderfully surprising to me were these notions of internal and external race as they manifest here. So can you say a little bit about that? What's going on with internal and external race, and why is this important to the larger argument that you're making in this part of the book?
I wanted to show how ideas of race, or possibly we could say ethnicity, they're hard terms to nail down, but ideas of race, we'll just say, sometimes linked with geography, sometimes linked with diet, sometimes linked with stature, often linked with the craniometric studies, but how ideas of the, what I call the races of France, factor into naval staffing decisions. So the internal dimensions of race then would be looking at the various ethnicities of France. So we could say that there are Basque peoples living in southwestern France, and the Navy wrote about them and the appropriate sorts of careers that they might have in the Navy, which tend to be something like a lookout, but also someone who is very good at climbing rigging, very athletic but small. Conversely, or additionally, I guess I should say, there were other sorts of ethnicities as well, like the Norman race and also the Provençal race to the south. And the Navy, in their staffing decisions, their manuals of hygiene, in fact, the official one, the main one that I write about, they basically say, well, these ethnicities have certain kinds of necessities of diet. They have certain habits of cleanliness. They have certain proclivities, we should say, human a diversity of human skills. The Navy needs all of them, but Norman people, for example, they could be trusted with, say, long voyages, particularly to the North Seas. They can handle that sort of thing, but they tend to drink a lot, so you shouldn't charge them with something like navigation or steering the ship. Secondarily, though, if we could just contrast that for a moment with the Provençal, as they say, race. But again, the people that came into the Navy from, we'll say, the Marseille or Toulon area down in the Mediterranean, that they're regarded as being quite sober, but they have a bad temper. So they have certain sorts of voyages that they seem to be, at least the naval physicians think they're appropriate for, and also certain tasks. So that was, in a nutshell, I think, what I was looking at in terms of internal racism as the races of France, staffing decisions, and they're made on what we would say, the staffing decisions, as far as I can tell, some of them were made on this this sort of categorization of ethnicities. External racism, I would define as, and this is the French nation and also many of the French naval physicians that I wrote about, looking outward, particularly to Africa in terms of the racial, in terms of staffing decisions, again, for the French Navy and the proclivities of Africans, not only in colonial ports, say in Senegal, for example, but also in terms of staffing on ships. So you would find, for example, depending on the naval ship, people that were tending the boilers or the coal, the stokers, I guess we would call them, on ship. And they tend to be, the majority of them tended to be African that would sign on with the French Navy for a while. And so, again, I think if, in looking at the ecology of the ship, there is, in the ecology of staffing, the French physicians were using racial ideas, both internally to look at the races of France and place them appropriately, and also externally in terms of the colonial dominions of France.
Great. So this chapter, in sort of exploring this, it's going to argue for, again, revisions in how we understand the history of race and racial ideas in this context, alongside arguing that French naval and colonial physicians were far more pluralist and less essentialist in their racial thinking than has been previously portrayed. This chapter is also arguing that race here is not straightforwardly a biological category, and again brings out the importance of notions of space and place and culture to racial concepts. Now, one of the other really interesting case studies that comes up in this chapter leads us into a chance to introduce one of the more interesting figures in this part of the book. So the chapter looks at the case study of yellow fever, and calls yellow fever a signature disease of colonial medicine. Now, this is also a case study that various actors in your story are using to work out notions of race. And one of those actors is a doctor named Laurent Jean-Baptiste Béringer Fereau. So he's working on yellow fever in this chapter. He also winds up being a key figure in the next chapter. And he winds up being involved in reform in this period. So to lead us forward in the story and bring us into what's happening in chapter 4 in particular, could you introduce Béringer Fereau for us? What was interesting about him? What's crucial for us to understand in order to understand the work he's doing in this story? And if you could just give us a kind of a portrait of him and talk about his importance.
Thanks. Well, one of the things that I used yellow fever for throughout the book was, as I said, a signature disease of colonialism, is that, of course, with yellow fever, there is, as far as we can tell, we moderns, a differential mortality and morbidity sort of a vector there between, for example, Africans, particularly if they've been, or Caribbean peoples who have been exposed to yellow fever, and people from Northern Europe. And Béringer Fereau was, as far as we can tell, someone who was an illegitimate son from Toulon, and who nearly rises to the very top of the naval medical hierarchy. He has a lifelong engagement with yellow fever, but also other sorts of epidemics throughout the empire. One, for example, is in West Africa at Saint-Louis in Senegal, what becomes Senegal. Also, he encounters yellow fever in the American Caribbean. He is there working for a number of years, and he writes voluminous volumes about this. He was a man who never married. He was a person who changed his name a number of times, possibly because he was worried about his illegitimacy. But he chooses the Navy as a career. And he is a surgeon who wins an MD degree. And he is a person, too, who survives and takes as many as 19 postings on ship or overseas. So, and he's wounded in the Franco-Prussian War. He most certainly contracted malaria and survived that. We're not sure about yellow fever. That's one of the things I was able to do. I mentioned how wonderful the naval records are. Get into the health reports of the physicians themselves. So they have a not only mental and behavioral attachments to place, the place attaches to them in terms of the diseases that they contracted. Béringer Fereau, who after several postings comes back to Toulon as the highest ranking medical officer in the port. And this is in late 19th century. And logically, he should be the person who is chair of what we'll call the Port Medical Council, which runs all the medicine, all the naval medicine, I should say, which is 90% of it, in the port of Toulon. The only black mark on his record is that he has never been a professor at one of the three naval medical schools, and it has been traditional at the time he achieves the apogee of his career for the person who chairs the Port Medical Council to be a professor at one of the naval medical schools, and he isn't. This precipitates a crisis in the Navy, and as the upshot of that, three book bombs are posted to people in Paris who, they're not just people, but there are people who are involved in the reform of naval medicine, which basically pulls from the grasp of Béranger Farreau the highest, his ability, I should say, to run, in fact, not only naval medicine in the port of Toulon, but the entire panorama of French medicine. So what happens is book bombs arrive in Paris. One is at the home of the new army/civilian colonial medicine unit, which starts up at the not just unit but organization that starts up and will be placed in actually Marseille, the Farreau Hospital, for training the new tier of French colonial physicians. And one of the people who starts that in Paris receives a book bomb. A minister also receives a book bomb. And then there's a third person. The bombs do not go off, but it's determined that they were posted from Toulon. And, in fact, it's known that some of the recipients of these bombs have certain kind of medical diseases. And the books, which contain fulminate of mercury, for example, and blasting caps from rifle ammo and whatnot, the book bombs don't go off, but the books that enclose them were specifically targeted at these three people. So the implication, according to the police, was that whoever did this knew these people in very intimate detail. So, for example, one of the people had served as a representative in the French government from Algeria, which was known as a place of syphilis, and he gets a book on venereal disease. Another person who was known to have, of these three who received the bombs, was known to have intestinal complaints, and he receives a book about intestinal complaints. So the French National Police and the Navy itself subsequently goes down to Toulon, where the books were posted from, and they interview Béranger Farreau. Now, Béranger Farreau had been involved for a number of years in championing those who sailed on ship over the privileged professors who taught in the naval port schools. This was not as it is today, where you rotate through being a professor in one of the naval or army medical schools, and then you go out into the field. These were people that took a post on land and just stayed there for the rest of their career. So, and in terms of advancement to higher ranks, you needed to have been a professor. So Béranger Farreau had portrayed himself as the voice of what's called the navigants, the people that, the surgeons in particular, that sail on ship. This sort of incident is brought to the book bomb incident then brings these sorts of issues to the fore. And what happens is that naval medicine is reformed, and a new centralized medical school is built at Bordeaux. In terms of Béranger Farreau, he was also one of the people who has been portrayed in the historiography as someone who is an essentialist, sort of a racialist or person promoting essentialist race theories. But in fact, what I showed in terms of immunity or partial immunity to yellow fever, some of his ideas about what constitutes the provincial race, but also the races of Africans and Caribbean peoples. He is very pluralistic in terms of sorts of things. When he talks about the ethnic selectivity, for example, of yellow fever, and he's very pluralistic in terms of looking at these races. Races can change. This does not seem to be fixed. In other words, these various peoples that he's looking at, he's saying that, you know, they're not just an expression of some of their anthropological makeup. There are some other things happening here. So basically then, in looking at yellow fever and also at, again, the ethnicities of the people of Provence, for example, which Benoît Farot writes about, I tried to take a look at what I think is a counter-narrative in terms of the acceptance of an anthropological essentialist idea of the races of humankind as being fairly fixed, if not the characteristics fixed, over the long 19th century.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And as we move from the chapter that really takes us into the story of these reforms, as you've just mentioned, then we move into two chapters of the book, and these are, before the conclusion, the last two chapters of the book, that look at the new civilian and army colonial medicine that emerges after the demise of the port medical school system that got dismantled as a result of the reforms in Chapter 4. So Chapter 5 focuses on Marseille and on the key institutions of colonial science and medicine in Marseille. Since part of the argument of the book and part of the real, I think, one of the many important contributions of the book is to take us into some of the places of medicine, again, and to look at their particularities here, let's look a little bit at Marseille. Can you talk a little bit about what was particular about Marseille as a place in this period, and how does that particularity shape the story of colonial medicine that emerges in this part of the book?
Well, in 1905, after these this series of reforms, the army opens the Faro, that's Pharo, but basically a postgraduate medical school for physicians bound to the colonies. The reason that there are many reasons why this postgraduate medical school is located in Marseille, but one of the major ones, if not the major one, is that Marseille has more people that are suffering from what are typed as tropical diseases than any other city in France. And so if you want to train physicians who have at least seen someone who has malaria or yellow fever or the ulcer of Indochina or these other sorts of diseases, there are a lot of people that suffer from this in Marseille. So that's one of the reasons. Secondly, there was a panorama of colonial institutions in Marseille. So if you were going to, for example, cite a new school for training colonial medicine physicians, excuse me, in Marseille, Marseille had many backup institutions. So, for example, one of the things that it has is a huge colonial museum, a commercial museum, and in particular, they have a chamber of commerce that has dealt since the 17th century with the Levant, so the Eastern Mediterranean and Eurasia and beyond. And they also have people who care about and fund colonial medicine. The people would include owners of shipping companies. So they're not unlike what we saw for colonial medicine in the United Kingdom, particularly at Liverpool. The shipping interests care about colonial diseases. Things like yellow fever, one of the reasons it's a signature disease is that it disrupts commerce, as Mario Espinosa wrote about in her very fine book on yellow fever in Cuba. I mean, it's fundamental to health reform in many ways. Thirdly, there is a faculty of sciences, but not a full faculty of medicine in Marseille. And the people, I should say the scientists in Marseille, are very, very interested to have a full faculty of medicine. And in fact, they finally get one. It's not until the 20th century, but they are extremely supportive then of having colonial physicians, training of colonial physicians, physicians who would know something about the diseases of the empire in Marseille. In the book, the last thing I'll just say, I think, in terms of the colonial context of Marseille, is that outside of Paris, it's Marseille that hosts the largest of all colonial expositions in France in terms of visitors. They hold one in 1922, right after World War I, but in 1906, Marseille also hosts a colonial exposition that had 1,800,000 visitors, for example. And so there is a vast interest throughout the community of Marseille in things colonial. And part of it is that the industries of Marseille, such as we think of soap manufacture, for example, they're switching over from using pressed olive oil, although they're still doing some of that, to crops that are palm oils, for example, crops that are and feedstuffs that are grown in the French colonies. So there's a whole panorama of people and institutions who really care about the colonies in Marseille.
Great. Thank you so much. And just for listeners who are particularly interested in the history of plants and animals and commodities in this context, we won't have time to talk about this in any detail, but I'll just signal for them that part of this chapter looks at a figure, Edouard Haeckel, who has an Institut Colonial and a museum, or Musée Colonial, where he studies and promotes products derived from colonial flora and fauna. And so part of this chapter looks at his work at this 1906 exposition and also looks at his effort to promote, to use, to study kola nuts in particular. So there's a really interesting sort of historical case study on kola nuts in this chapter, which is, I think, particularly fascinating for those interested in the histories of commodities and materia medica and foodstuffs and that sort of stuff. So as we move from Chapter 5 to Chapter 6, we move from Marseille to Paris. And Chapter 6 looks particularly at the founding of the Paris Faculty of Medicine's Institute of Colonial Medicine. So here, this is not just a shift for us to Paris. It's also in many ways a shift in the kind of style of and the scope of colonial medicine and a move to a new kind of universal tropical medicine. This is an important point in the story. To maybe mirror our discussion of the previous chapter, since we're moving from one place to another, and that move is really important, what do we need to understand about Paris as a place in this period in order to understand some of the important ways that it differed, and differed specifically in terms of what you're arguing here, from the kinds of places that we've discussed? So, put briefly, what's special about Paris, and what do we need to know about Paris as a place to understand how it's functioning in the argument that you're making in this part of the book?
Chapter 6 does, in fact, look at the Paris Faculty of Medicine. I think most of what we know or we knew about colonial medicine in Paris was the Pasteur Institute, and there are overseas Pasteur Institutes, and I talked briefly about that, but there's also, in terms of training colonial physicians, and again, it's a postgraduate school that is comes together there at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, is at the Paris Faculty of Medicine. What we need to know about the place of Paris is that it is one of the most populous cities in Europe, even at the end of the 19th century. Secondarily, in terms of training French physicians, if we could just step back and look at the number of physicians, those are people that win MDs that are trained in the 19th century, the vast majority are trained at the Paris Faculty of Medicine as opposed to other faculties that are in the provinces. So in terms of colonial medicine, what I tried to do was talk about or show how a medical parasitologist by the name of Raphael Blanchard, who becomes a professor of parasitology at Paris Faculty of Medicine, uses the colonies to further his own career. So that's the trajectory. By using the colonies, again, this is a person who set up colonial networks. He had naval physicians who sent him bugs in matchboxes, sometimes preserved, sometimes not. He's a person who brought three people suffering from sleeping sickness to Paris, which, as far as I can tell, was the first time that had ever happened, to study the three Africans who unfortunately all died in Paris. But it was pretty much a death sentence if you had something like the trypanosome that causes sleeping sickness for all of the 19th century and for much of the 20th. So what I try to show is how Blanchard, through what he taught, through his organizational skills, and through his editing of journals, how he enfranchised colonial knowledge and how he brought that to the table, even though he is a person who in many ways steps away from the traditions of medical geography, is very focused on what we historians of medicine would call etiology and on microscopy, how he incorporates then colonial knowledge into this newer form of colonial medicine.
So in addition to this move, or at least part of this move that I mentioned earlier from a port-based local and regional naval and colonial medicine, which is what we saw in most of the book, to this new regime of a universal tropical medicine, is a move by the end of this story from what you call localism to centralization. Since this is a significant move, as a way of kind of bringing us out of the story, can you talk a little bit about the significance of this transition? What's going on here, and what do we need to understand about this larger move from localism to centralization in this context?
Well, one of the things that is happening with this transition is that the port naval medical schools in Rochefort, Brest, and Toulon are downsized to just be basically schools that give you the first year of a medical training, and then you would go to a medical faculty or to Bordeaux. So one of the things that is happening there is that in many ways the sort of localism that I talked about gets left behind. So in terms of the traditions of naval medicine, and particularly encountering or taking a whole class, for example, in medical geography at a naval medical school, you wouldn't get that sort of thing in Paris. You might get some of it, but you wouldn't get as much there. The newer empire, too, will be based not so much on the idea that the French will be settlers and we will have French settlement colonies, but that we will have a few French agents, hopefully vaccinated or safe from things like malaria and yellow fever, who will go organize workers in the colonies. Now, in terms of older ideas about empire and colonialism, there's a much more intimate, I think, engagement with the terrain of the colonies, and the naval physicians were engaged in that. With someone like Bélanger Farreau and certainly his colleagues, they do want some colonial knowledge, and they certainly want samples for their laboratory classes that they're teaching in terms of this or that sort of a vector can cause you to go ill. But in fact, they're not very interested in the local context, at least not of the colonies, not in the way certainly that the naval physicians were. So the culmination then, we go back to Paris. Recently what's happened is that naval medicine and colonial medicine has moved to suburban Paris. And in fact, that happened in the summer of 2013, and also to the inland, which Paris is actually quite a substantial port because it's got the Seine River moving through there. But secondarily, the rest of the institutions were moved to Lyon, which, as far as I know, is not a naval port. It's just downhill there from Geneva in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. Now, thank you so much. Now, toward the end of the story, in the conclusion, you move us out into the more recent past, into this late and last, really, part of the story. But you also move us out from the context of history of medicine and disease and colonial medicine to start incorporating rather figures that perhaps are better known from the history of art and the history of literature. And one of these figures who is super fascinating in this context is the last person I'll ask you about before we come to a close. And this is the figure of Victor Segalen. Depending on whether you pronounce it like a New Jersey Italian American, like I do, or somebody who knows what they're doing. Ken, as a way of kind of moving us out into this larger, really humanistic frame that you give us so beautifully in the last chapter of the book and in the conclusion, can you talk a little bit about him? What is he doing in this story, and what does this engagement with the arts have to do with it?
Well, one of the things that was so compelling about this topic for me was that these physicians, these naval physicians, many of them were also writing novels. Béranger Farreau was writing local histories. Some of his friends were writing about myths. And if we might think of that painting that Picasso did in 1937 of the Minotaur, I think it's called, we see a landscape, and then we see this god appearing on the landscape of Provence. And I was trying to uncover, I think, that sensibility, that attachment to place. And literature, music, language, Provençal, for example, Occitan, these are ways of attachments to place. And in terms of Segalen, he is engaged in a critique of exoticism. He travels after Gauguin's death, the painter. He actually buys and incorporates some of Gauguin's paintings and some other things. I think his walking stick. And Segalen, and you're correct in not knowing how to pronounce this, because Segalen changes his name to look more like he's a Breton than French by removing an accent and sometimes putting it in. But basically, he is really the model, I think, for the newer engagement with the colonies, which is very questioning. In other words, is this a good thing? Is empire a good thing? Worries about the French, in fact, homogenizing the world, which I didn't expect to find this critique, really, of imperialism and colonialism from within the Navy. Segalen was a very interesting guy. I portray him as a hybrid figure in this transition, who subsequently becomes the namesake for the University of Bordeaux III, which is the medical school in Bordeaux.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for making time to talk with me about this super fascinating book. We've talked about a lot of moments from it, but of course there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Well, I hope my book will give listeners and those who read it a sense of the places, I won't say place, but places of France, of and maybe an affection for those places. But also, I think, help, at least the book helped me to reconceptualize how I think about place, and that it's not just something's passive or space-laden, but how it actually figures into things like diagnosis, ideas of disease, etiology, actions, and how place can be enabling as well as limiting. So I think if there's a take-home message from the book, it's that one about how we understand place and how really this is a plea to have place enfranchised in history of science and medicine in a way that perhaps it hasn't been done before.
Great. Well, congratulations on the book. And now that it's out, what's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you?
I have two. One, I kept saying that after two books on the tropics or the neotropics or exotic animals, that I would work on alpine environments, and I've started that. But the next one up for me is a biography of yellow fever, a short biography of yellow fever, a global history of it.
Great. Well, best of luck with those projects, Mike. Thanks again for making time. It really was a pleasure. And best of luck with the new material.
Thanks, Carla. Nice to chat with you.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.